prevent a deranged or fanatic crew member from starting a nuclear war. The butterfly valve lock on the Stage 1 rocket engine offered some additional control over who could launch the missile. Oxidizer wouldn't flow into that engine until the correct butterfly valve lock code, BVLC, was used during the launch checklist. And without the oxidizer, the missile would stay in the silo. This code wasn't kept in the safe or anywhere else on the complex. It was transmitted with the emergency war order from SAC. And the valve lock contained a small explosive device. Any attempt to tamper with the lock set off the explosive and sealed the oxidizer line shut. The SAC two-man rule governed not only how the missile was launched, but also how the complex was run. At least two authorized personnel always had to be present and within visual range of each other in the control center. You couldn't allow the other person out of your sight. The same rule applied in the silo whenever the missile had a warhead. At entrances to the control center and the silo, a warning stenciled in bold red letters said, "No lone zone. SAC two-man policy mandatory." The commander and the deputy commander at every Titan II site were issued .38 caliber revolvers in case an intruder penetrated the underground complex or a crew member disobeyed orders. Transferring the weapons was part of the turnover checklist when a new crew arrived for duty. In addition to the handguns and their holsters, Mazzaro and Childers received some bad news from the crew preparing to leave 4-7. Pressure in the Stage 2 oxidizer tank was low. A PTS team would have to visit the site, and most of the day would have to be devoted to major maintenance. Before the other crew departed, Mazzaro and Childers opened the safe, made sure the cookies and launch keys were inside, shut it, and installed their own locks. For the next hour or so, Mazzaro, Childers, Holder, and Fuller went through the daily shift verification, DSV checklist in the control center. They checked every piece of equipment on all three levels of the center, every gauge, switch, and warning light. Level 3 was the basement. It housed the DC power supplies and battery backups, switching equipment for the communications systems, the air conditioning and ventilation systems. Fresh air was pulled into the control center from outdoors, filtered, cooled, and then sent throughout the rest of the complex. The positive airflow helped to protect the crew from toxic vapors that might drift from the silo. The go-to-war safe, the tall steel cabinets, and the launch consoles were on level 2. The top floor, level 1, had a kitchen, a small round table, 4 chairs, a toilet, and 4 beds. The complex had enough food to last for a month, but its emergency diesel generator had enough fuel for only 2 weeks. During wartime, the crew might find itself eating canned and dehydrated military rations in the dark. PTS Team A was scheduled to pressurize the Stage 2 oxidizer tank at the complex. The 8-man team was led by senior airman Charles T. Heineman, who would direct its work from the control center. Airman David W. Adderhold, Eric Ayala, and Richard D. Willinghurst would remain topside to operate the nitrogen tank. Adderhold and Ayala would be in REFCO suits. Airmen Roger A. Hamm and Gregory W. Lester would stay in the blast lock as backup to the men working in the silo, ready to put on their REFCOs in an emergency. And airmen David Powell and Jeffrey Plum would enter the silo in REFCOs, remove the pressure cap, and attach the nitrogen line. Powell and Plum hoped to get started on the missile early in the afternoon, but the work platforms wouldn't descend from the silo walls. They were stuck in the upright position. A repair crew was working on them. Something was wrong with the hydraulic system, and troubleshooting with help from the tech manuals couldn't fix it. The hassles continued to mount. The hydropneumatic accumulator was broken, and without it, the platforms couldn't be lowered. And the repair crew didn't have the right parts. If pressure in the Stage 2 oxidizer tank dropped any further, the missile would have to be taken off alert. SAC headquarters was never pleased when a missile went off alert, and so a helicopter was sent from Little Rock Air Force Base with the parts. Meanwhile, Rodney Holder and Ron Fuller continued to go through the daily shift verification checklist, walking down the long corridor to the silo. The cableway was essentially a big steel pipe, braced with girders and springs, that stretched almost 50 yards from the blast lock to the silo. The floor was painted gray, the walls and ceilings turquoise. Bundles of pipes and cables snaked overhead and along both sides. It looked like the interior of a submarine that was somehow underground, not underwater. The silo's 9 levels were crammed with equipment, and the checklist there took about 2 hours to complete. It had hundreds of steps. Sometimes crews would cut corners to speed things up. They'd divide the labor. You check this air compressor, I'll check that one, and violate the SAC 2-man rule, roaming separately through the silo and comparing notes later. It was faster that way. The violation seemed trivial, and officers in the control center had no way of knowing what the enlisted men were doing in the silo. The television camera in the access portal, aimed at the entrapment area, was the only one in the complex. From the control center, you couldn't see what was happening in the cableways, the blast lock, the silo, or topside. There was no periscope. And one officer could not leave the other alone in the control center to check on what crew members were doing elsewhere. That would be a serious violation of the 2-man rule. Holder and Fuller did everything by the book that day. As members of an instructor crew, they took pride in being considered among the best at the job. A standardization evaluation team was soon going to be judging their work, and Holder wanted a high score. Doing things properly added only 15 minutes or so to the job. Before joining the Air Force, he'd been a construction worker, building highway bridges in rural Arkansas. A career in the military hadn't appealed to him at first. His father was a former NFL player who joined the Naval Reserve during the Korean War and wound up spending more than 2 decades as a naval officer. Holder had attended grade schools in 3 different countries and high schools in 4 different states. At the age of 19, he liked doing construction work but worried about the future. The military promised a more interesting and rewarding life. Joining the Navy wasn't an option. Holder got seasick too easily. So he joined the Air Force, eager to learn about missiles. Working on the Titan II had revealed that, deep down, he was a techno geek.